We are a nation of drug users. We take them in the morning to wake up, at midday to stay up, and at night to go down. All this use leads us to ask, what happens to all those drugs when we are finished with them?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 668th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Pucallpa, Peru, who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards.
Hi.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello.
And hey, a studio audience, Alice Facchioli sitting in. Hello, Alice.
Hello, Michael.
Folks, we are a nation of drug users. As I said earlier, we take them in the morning to wake up, at midday to stay up, and at night to go down. When our bodies are finished with the drugs, what's left is expelled and flushed down the drain. The water carrying our drugs is treated before being released downstream, where it will be treated again and served up as drinking water to those who live downstream. But wait, not all of the drugs we consume can be removed from the drinking water of those who live downstream. In fact, a vast array of antibiotics, anticonvulsants, mood stabilizers, and sex hormones have been found in the drinking water of 41 million Americans. And so today we ask, what happens to all those drugs when we are finished with them? Here to help us fish around in the water for some reasoning here, we have Alan Roberson, who is Director of Security and Regulatory Affairs for the American Waterworks Association. Alan, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good to have you aboard. You're in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I am.
Where there's a lot of water, right?
Yes, in fact, some of it's coming down in a white form today.
Oh, that's the best form. Love it. So, Alan, what is the American Waterworks Association?
We're the scientific and technical association representing drinking water. So we have members that are water utilities, consulting engineers that design the treatment plants, manufacturers that make the pumps, pipes, and valves that are used in drinking water, mm-hmm. and then researchers that do work on issues like we're talking about today.
Good, and we always ask, who pays the way?
It's paid by the members. We get our revenues split from dues, you know, just part of being mm-hmm. in a society, you have to pay dues. We have educational products, you know, books and videos. And then we run conferences, so people pay a registration to come to our conference to learn the latest about the issues.
Good enough. Also with us today, George Menina, who is an attorney, an environmental attorney, and a partner of Nossaman, LLP, also Washington, D.C., right, George?
Yes. Good morning.
Good. Welcome aboard. Welcome to the Food Chain. Pleasure to have you here. You're also in Washington, D.C.?
I am indeed.
Good. And Nossaman, LLP, who are you?
We are a 150-person law firm.
George, are you on a remote phone or something?
I am indeed.
Something's not working, and perhaps we can have producer Carol Stafford call you back because you're breaking up really badly. So I'm going to try to reconnect. Is that okay?
That's absolutely fine.
Okay, thanks, George. We'll be right back with George. We're also hoping today, folks, to hear from Elizabeth Trotwin. Elizabeth is a registered nurse who emailed in when she got her press release for this radio show. And let's see, I'll turn this one off. So Elizabeth emailed in. She's a registered nurse. And she said, Michael, I sold my house in the city and I moved to the country because I know what's in the water. So I said, well, will you join us? We'd love to hear from you as well. So maybe Elizabeth will be so kind as to join us today as well. So we are talking water, and we are talking with water with people who really know about water. And we have Alan Roberson, who is the Director of Security and Regulatory Affairs, American Waterworks Association. And coming up, we have George Menina, who is an environmental attorney with Nossaman LLP, which is a major law firm there in Washington, D.C. And I believe that what George does is that he watches over the environmental waterworks and kind of minds it as attorneys do the medical profession as well. So Carol has him on the phone. We'll pick him up in just a minute. But until then, let's go to Alan. Alan, the Associated Press says that there are pharmaceutical drugs in the drinking water of 41 million Americans. As a journalist, I don't believe anyone, especially those with whom I agree. Is there any indication that this 41 million person number is right?
Well, yeah, it's probably correct, Michael. I've read the Associated Press story, and what's happened in the last 10 years is that we've gotten improved analytical methods, you know, new instrumentation that drops down the ability to detect a few orders of magnitude. And so what we're finding now in the last decade is that, yeah, people are doing sampling, they're finding it, whereas 20, 30 years ago, frankly, these were probably always there, and just we didn't have this advanced technology to be able to make the detection.
Mm-hmm. So essentially we've gone from, you know, seeing things floating in our water to being able to measure parts per 100 and then parts per 1,000 and parts per million.
Happened in the last 10 years, we've actually gone from parts per billion to parts per trillion.
Sounds like the federal debt. Wow.
A little bit, yeah.
So essentially we can find anything anywhere then. And so it's pretty safe to say that something in whatever quantity is in the food chain, and it's just a matter of how much is there.
Right.
Good. George, are you there? Are you back?
I am back.
Oh, and you sound much better, too. George Bonina, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we left off with your law firm, and you could tell us a little bit about yourself there.
All right. We are a 150-person law firm with offices throughout California, as well as in Austin, Texas, and Washington, D.C. I, after graduating from Cornell, went to work on Capitol Hill and was privileged to work for a congressional committee as a counsel that had jurisdiction over environmental issues, and then went to the law firm, mm-hmm. where I've worked on environmental issues for more years than we want to remember.
Good. Well, I just asked Alan Warburson this question. You know, the Associated Press says that there are 41 million people who are drinking water contaminated with pharmaceuticals to one extent or another. And, of course, Alan talked about how we can find, you know, minute particles down to parts per trillion in just about everything. Is that kind of follow true with what you see, too?
Yes, our methods of detection have improved dramatically.
So it's safe. It's pretty safe to say that you could find almost anything almost everywhere then, given that you could find it in parts per trillion, right?
Well, you certainly can find it. I think that what's caused the concern among some scientists is that even absent the definitive study of exactly what's happening and exactly mm-hmm. what the impacts are, there have been a lot of studies and anecdotal evidence that suggest that even small concentrations can potentially have adverse effects on fish, wildlife, and indeed on humans.
Right. Well, before we head off in that direction, I'd like to ask the both of you, is it just municipal drinking water we're talking about? What about the water we get from wells, and what about the water we get from, you know, bottled water at the store?
Well, I think generally, you know, the most of the studies have been done in drinking water because that gets a lot of the interest, but mm-hmm. and most private wells are groundwater, so they're probably less vulnerable, but that doesn't mean that they might not have impacts from agricultural chemicals or things that might be used in that area. And then bottled water, it all boils down to how that water is treated and what kind of treatment they have and what their source is. But in all likelihood, if you tested bottled water at with these new advanced technologies you have for detecting other parts per trillion, you would find a lot of the same results that's been reported in the AP.
Okay.
Yeah, Alan's right that there are bottled water depends on their source. About, 40% of us get our water from underground aquifers.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, the Associated Press investigative team did find the presence of pharmaceuticals in those aquifers.
Right. It's here, it's there, it's everywhere. Pretty much is what they discovered. They discovered, and they also talked about, The bottled water that we buy in the stores probably has it in it, because there's really no way to get it out in parts per trillion, right?
It's very difficult, and you know, I feel for Alan and his colleagues, because most of our, and Alan's certainly expert here, and I'll defer to him on all of this, but most of our water treatment facilities are not designed and have never been designed to remove chemicals at these levels of concentration. And the costs of retrofitting them to address that issue would be enormous, and continuing because of the number of drugs that are introduced into the marketplace each year.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think that's right on track. You know, even advanced treatment is not going to take out 100% of these kind of compounds. So if you put in the advanced treatment and you took out 99%, that might lower the concentration from 100 parts per trillion to 1 part per trillion, but you still have that one.
So
you know, we have this issue of detection may not necessarily equal an adverse health effect. And so it's really difficult to take out 100%.
Okay, folks, you're tuned into the Food Chain. Today we're talking about the pharmaceuticals in our water. There's a lot of things in our water, but there's also the pharmaceuticals that we take to pick us up in the morning and to keep us up at midday and to put us down in the evening. So you look in your medicine cabinet and you see all of those drugs that you get from the drugstore, and what's going to happen to them? Well, eventually they're going to go down the toilet, right? Whether you use them or you just throw them in the toilet, it seems like that's where they're headed, and that's where our water is. So what on earth happens to the drugs in our water? Right back. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, it's a fact. 41 million of us, probably more, probably, but 41 million of us have pharmaceutical drugs in our drinking water. Well, how do they get there? Well, of course, we go to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Doctor, I don't feel good. Give me something to make me feel good." The doctor gives us something to make me feel good. We go home and we take the drugs, and some of those drugs make us feel good, but some of them go right through our body and into the toilet and down the drain and into the drinking water, and downstream it goes, and it's captured downstream and retreated and served up as drinking water to those who live downstream. But all of the treatment is not able to get drugs out of the drinking water in the parts per billion or the parts per trillion or whatever comes after trillion. So there we're stuck with pharmaceutical drugs in our drinking water. So we ask, what impact are those drugs having on our bodies? Does anybody know, Alan? Has your organization ever given that any consideration?
Yes, we have a sister organization called the Water Research Foundation, and they've done a couple of. It's a big issue for our members, clearly, and
sure.
So they've invested some money into research and had a couple of studies that came out last year that looked at sort of both the state of the knowledge of the treatment and occurrence information, mm-hmm. but also a study on the toxicological relevance.
Well,
how
could there be a state of the knowledge when, you know, we're just discovering the fact that this stuff exists in parts per trillion?
Well, it's really just sort of compiling all that in one place, mm-hmm. so that our members, the utilities, would understand about occurrence,
right.
and the methods and the treatment and the health effects, so they'd have sort of one book that, you know, a snapshot at time. Even though, like you said, there's a ton of research needs, at least you have a reference book to go to,
right.
that explain that.
This is what we know.
This is what we know as of, you know, that time frame. And I think that at least I think it was helpful for a lot of people to be able to go back and even you know, say as of 2008, here's the state of the art. In the same time frame, they built on that and did a study on the toxicological relevance. And this, again, came out in 2009. So it just looked at the margin of safety, what's typically found in drinking water versus the toxicological information that's developed when these pharmaceuticals go through the registration process at the Food and Drug Administration. And what this study found was pretty large margins of safety in the order of, you know, 2,000 to 6 million, depending on the particular compound you were looking at. And
wait a minute. How does that work again?
Well, it compared the maximum concentration that's been found in drinking water
mm-hmm.
with the allowable daily intake that's developed as part of the registration process for the Food and Drug Administration and sort of what's the difference between those.
Okay, so with the maximum daily allowance is something that when the drug is introduced, the company that introduces it says this is how much, you know, you can. This is the maximum amount you can take per day, right?
Yeah, you know the. I mean, that's the one piece of good news about this mm-hmm. is that compared to a lot of other industrial compounds, there's a wealth of human health information
because it's been actually been studied, right?
Exactly, because yeah. they have to do that through the clinical trials to be able to produce it under the FDA.
As opposed to something like perchlorate.
Yeah, there are other compounds or, you know, another chemical compound that
nobody knows anything about.
You may not have the same level of human test data.
Okay.
You know? I mean, that's the one piece of good news. Now, so anyway, there's a big difference between, you know, what the therapeutic doses are and what we're finding in drinking water. Now,
sure.
That doesn't completely answer the question, and there are other questions that need to be furthered. Is that how does that, you know, when you take these, when you take a prescription for a short period of time, that's what it's designed for, a higher dose at a short period of time. There is a legitimate question about, well, what does it happen if you have this very low dose for a long period, and that does need to be studied,
right.
along with the question of mixtures, you know, what you find in drinking water. Is
sure, it, like antibiotics, anticonvulsants, mood stabilizers,
yeah.
sex
right.
hormones, all,
yes.
all
yes.
poured into the one glass.
Yeah.
And
yeah. So there are questions that still need to be answered in more research, but the research that was done last year at least showed this, these large margins of safety between,
mm-hmm.
you know, what we're finding in drinking water, and that provides some comfort. Again, it doesn't discount the need to do more research to answer these other questions.
Good enough. George Menina, are you comfortable with that knowledge?
Well, I think that Alan's right, that more needs to be done, but there are some disquieting studies that have been done in the laboratory which suggests that very low concentrations of various pharmaceuticals can accelerate human breast cancer growth, slow human embryonic cell growth, affect kidneys and immune systems, result in the onset of diabetes, or at least accelerate that. And we're just talking human health. I assume in a moment you'll want to talk about fish and wildlife impacts, which we can discuss as well, but I think the essential point here is to step back for a moment that regardless of what the studies may say and regardless of what the safety margins are, it's, to me at least, intuitively obvious that putting substances like arsenic into the environment is probably not a good thing, even if we have large safety margins. And I think that there are really a couple issues. You know, Alan's focused, rightfully so, on a safety margin issue, but I think there's a larger issue of what can we do to help Alan and his members, frankly, by reducing the amount of pharmaceuticals that are indeed going into the environment.
Yeah,
there
we,
is some suggestive evidence.
Yeah, we definitely want to go in that direction. But let's go back to your suggestion of fish and wildlife. You know, I think about the Mississippi River that drains the entire country and goes out into the Gulf of Mexico. And should I eat the oysters?
Well, there are some issues. There are fish advisories and so forth that come, not necessarily because of pharmaceuticals, but because mm-hmm. of runoff from where we live.
Chemicals, sure.
Agricultural chemicals.
Sure.
And indeed, there are a substantial amount of antibiotics mm-hmm. that are distributed to pork and chicken and other producers, something in order of 28 million pounds worth.
Well, with antibiotics, of course, would be the biggie pharmaceutical contaminant in the environment because it's so ubiquitous. We use it for, you know, raising chickens. We use it for raising pork. We raise it for raising beef. It's whenever we take two animals and put them in a barn, you know, we feed them antibiotics, and then we're putting thousands of animals in barns. So, you know, the antibiotics are everywhere. Has anybody really looked at that? You know, have taken a beaker full of water out of the Mississippi River down by New Orleans and looked for antibiotics?
Well, there have been studies of water below both treatment plants and below discharge points for concentrated animal feeding operations, and those tests tend to show an increase in the amount of pharmaceuticals in the water. And indeed, if you look at tests below discharge points at hospitals and other facilities, you'll find a higher concentration of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which is not a good thing, given that I think the number I saw was 65,000 Americans die each year because of infections caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Right, so it's definitely in the environment. When we come back, I'd like to ask where all of these pharmaceutical drugs are coming from, because they're not just coming from us in agriculture. One of the people who called in, Elizabeth, mentioned the fact that she was a registered nurse and became so frightened of the city water that she ran away to the country where she lives on a well. So let's take a quick look at where these pharmaceuticals are coming from. When we come back, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, we're talking with Alan Roberson, who is with the American Water Works Association, representing the people that treat your water, and also George Menina, from an environmental attorney in Washington, D.C., who watches over everybody and makes certain that we're all playing by some rules. And you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, give us a call. Talk water. Right back. We are a nation of drug users. We take them in the morning to wake up. We take them in the afternoon to stay up. And we take them at night to go down. All of this use leads us to ask, what happens to all those drugs when we are finished with them? Well, what happens to them is that they go down the drain, of course, one way or another, and then they go into the drinking water of those who live downstream. And it's the people who work at the municipal water plants, of course, scrub the water and try to get all the contaminants out of it. But when you're able to measure things in parts per billion and parts per trillion, it's hard to scrub something in parts per trillion, if not impossible. And so we find it in our drinking water, and we realize that what we take upstream ends up to be what we take downstream. And so what does that mean to our bodies and our health, and the health of our environment, and the health of our animals and plants, and everything up and down the food chain? And here to talk about that with us today, we have Alan Roberson, who is with the American Water Works Association. American Water Works represents those people who tend our water. And, of course, every city and municipal government in the United States pretty much has its own water system. And then also with us today, George Menina, who is an environmental attorney, and he's one of those people who watches over everything and makes sure everybody's playing by the rules. George, is everybody playing by the rules?
Well, I think that we have people of really good intention who don't know what the rules are. And before the break, you talked about hospitals or other sources. And if I may, let me turn there for a moment.
Please do.
Because our hospitals and healthcare facilities are dumping about 250 million pounds of hazardous pharmaceutical waste into the environment each year. And those are much more toxic substances.
How much did you say?
250 million pounds.
Uh-huh.
And that's a much more toxic substance than that which you and I have in our medicine chest, because hospitals are giving us powerful oncology drugs and things that we just can't have at home. What's interesting is that our hospital professionals, their first priority is and has to be patient care. But there are 160,000 national drug codes. Now, I don't know about you, Michael, but I certainly couldn't remember how to dispose of 160,000 drugs. And mistakes are made. And despite the fact that federal laws regulate the disposal of this stuff, the sad reality is that most hospital personnel really don't know what's required of them. In fact, EPA, Environmental Protection Agency studies have borne that out.
Is that a comment in the background I hear?
Yeah, I had to move. Sorry about that.
Okay, no problem. George, do you have a follow-up? Oh, that was George. Alan, do you have a follow-up? What about your perspective? You got hospitals upstream dumping this stuff into the water.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a legitimate issue that
I mean, as a water professional, you don't want to see that happening, do you?
No. I think there's legitimate issues that need to be addressed on hospitals and nursing homes, how they properly dispose of any you know, medications that are unused or get taken back. There are some localities that are looking at doing pharmacy take-back programs,
mm-hmm.
you know, be comparable like how you recycle, you know, motor oil and cell phones and sort of how we're trying to get beyond just paper and plastic these days and take care of a lot of recycling. But in a lot of cases, you know, the evidence I've seen, a lot of it is part of the pharmacology of these drugs themselves, and that only a certain percentage is absorbed into the body, and the vast majority
right.
is excreted out and ends up, like you said, in the toilet to begin with. And
so,
I think
so. One way or another, it always seems to end up in the toilet.
Yeah, I mean, I think the and I know in my discussions with the pharmaceutical companies, they're trying to work on you know, improving their drugs so that more gets absorbed and less gets excreted, but that's a you know, complicated process to do, and at the same time, they're trying to develop new drugs to take care of new medical problems all the time.
Well, we should look beyond, if I may, just the excretion issue, because that is significant, though that is. Just normal medical practices at a hospital result in the disposal of many drugs that are not excreted. For example, the standard packaging for a liquid injectable might be 10 cc's. The doctor might prescribe 6. The other 4 typically go down the into the sewer system. Or a patient recovers early or sadly dies, and the medications being given to that patient are disposed of. You go into an operating room. If any of the 3 of us have ever been there before, what we may not see is that there's typically a nurse with a belt of chemicals around his or her waist, that in case there's an adverse reaction that one of us has during the operation, they have the treatment right there to take care of us. When the surgery's over, mercifully, we come out well, and the drugs are disposed of because we didn't need them. So there are many instances in hospitals and healthcare facilities, nursing homes, where drugs are not administered to the patient and remain to be disposed of, and are disposed of typically through a sewer or landfill system. Not always, but very often, sadly.
So is there any other way of getting rid of these? I mean, I just think of the 300 million of us that are out there taking drugs and excreting them.
Well, I think there are, you know, appropriate medical waste disposal facilities. You know, when you go into a, you know, in my experience with the healthcare system, you go into the doctor's office or the hospital, they've got medical waste separated from the normal office waste. And if people do the right thing and put it in there, then that ends up being disposed of appropriately, either at some sort of medical waste site or hazardous waste site, just like we have to take care of a lot of hazardous waste material. So there are appropriate. I think the point that was made, and I think it's an important one, is that people have to follow that. You know, that it's the kind of procedure that has to be followed, you know, 100% of the time by everybody that's in the healthcare profession, I think.
And everybody that's taking drugs.
Yes, you know, exactly. Yeah.
The environmental.
There's a lot of personal responsibility by a lot of people, like you said. If
the Environmental Protection Agency in their Region 2, which is New York and New Jersey, did a multi-year study of volunteer hospitals. There were 37 hospitals that volunteered to test their pharmaceutical waste programs to determine whether they were in compliance with federal law, and none of the 37 were. Not because they're bad people, they're just overwhelmed by lack of understanding of what the law requires, lack of the ability to properly separate the hazardous and the non-hazardous wastes, And had this been an enforcement action, there would have been about $9 million in penalties levied against those hospitals. And if you talk to EPA people, they will suggest to you that that is probably not an atypical circumstance, because when they've surveyed hospitals, the normal percentage is about three-quarters of the staff and doctors and pharmacists don't know what's required for proper disposal.
Well, I think that could be, is a fair statement. Nobody thinks about it.
Yeah.
We're all taking drugs or using drugs, and when we're done with them, we just get rid of them one way or another, but nobody's thinking about it. The question is, do those people who live downstream of us think about it?
Well, I mean, I think they do. I think people, or at least I would hope, you know, people, you know, they want to know their water safe, just like they want to know their food
right.
Safe, or their air is safe. I mean, there's things that we can't live without, and we have these statutes that are supposed to try and do that, but there are human errors and lack of knowledge. There's a lot of issues that make it so it's not 100%.
Okay, quick break, right back. Do stay tuned. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about pharmaceuticals in the water, and we're talking about it with Alan Roberson, who is the Director of Security and Regulatory Affairs for the American Water Works Association. Those are the folks that clean your water so that you can drink it. And also George Menina, who is an environmental attorney, and his job is to watch over everybody and make certain that everybody's following the rules. But wait a minute. Out of 37 hospitals, not one of them was following the rules? Did I hear you right, George? Oops, I got to press the button here. Hold on. Let's try it this way. So, George, we heard that 30 out of 37 hospitals, not one of them was following the protocols?
Not one. They were all guilty of some error. And this is not because they're bad people or malice. It's just they don't know what they have to do. They sometimes don't have the proper tools. And our government has not done as good a job as it should about telling them what they have to do.
Okay. Alice, who's sitting in on the studio audience today, brought up a very interesting question. Alice used to work in the dental field. Alice, go ahead.
Where's OSHA in this whole thing? That's what I'd like to know. When I was in the dental field, I mean, we had OSHA as our umbrella, and there were regulations for everything, where the needles are going to be exposed or where they're going to be thrown. Everything. Where's OSHA in this whole thing?
Well, you're absolutely right to point to the failures of our regulators. The Environmental Protection Agency, again, people of good intentions, seem to be looking the other way at pharmaceuticals. There are probably 30,000 substances that the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health have said are carcinogenic, just a touch. And yet the Environmental Protection Agency has yet to look at its list of hazardous pharmaceuticals to see whether any of those should be disposed of at hazardous waste landfills or hazardous waste incinerators, the result being virtually all of them are disposed of in other ways, to municipal landfills or down the sewer, and we just don't have our regulators doing the job they should be doing.
Alan Roberson, American Water Works Association, where is OSHA?
Well, OSHA is really geared toward worker safety, and so I think that, you know, they're trying to protect the nurses and the dental technicians. Mm-hmm.
Thus the needles. Watch where the needles
go.
Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, they're focused on worker safety, and as George said, the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, that's their mission, to protect the environment. And it gets even more complicated because you get into other government agencies like the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, plays into that. This is one of the issues with the pharmacies being able to take back prescriptions. If there are some that are on their list of controlled substances, then that complicates the ability of the pharmacy to take it back in some sort of recycling kind of program. So that's one of the issues, is that this issue cuts across different agencies, and it can be confusing to the healthcare workers on exactly what they need to do, and individual consumers on what they need to do if they come across these unused medications.
Alan's absolutely right about the Drug Enforcement Administration. I know a few years ago when my mom passed away from cancer, the first thing the hospice care worker did was take me into the bathroom so I could be a witness as she dumped down the toilet all of the very potent painkillers and other pharmaceuticals that are regulated by DEA, because she's required by the Drug Enforcement Administration to do precisely that. And I have said a number of times that why can't the Drug Enforcement Administration protect its valuable mission of making certain the drugs are not diverted into the streets and used improperly? Why can't they and EPA figure out some way that EPA's important mission of protecting our water supplies and environment is also satisfied?
Well, here, with respect to managing them and figuring out what to do with them, we have a very interesting question here from Mel. Mel, welcome to the Food Chain. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I was in the county nurse's office recently, and he has pounds and pounds of unused medications in there. And I asked him what they're going to do with them now that they can't put them in the water, and he said they're going to be burning them. And my thought is 450,000 tons, I think you said, of this country being burned.
250 million pounds.
Pardon?
250 million pounds.
250 million deaths. If they all go to burning, isn't our air going to be toxified?
Okay, Mel, thanks for that question. I'm going to take you off the air so that we can pick up our other guests and talk with Alan and George. So, Mel says we're going to burn 250 million pounds of pharmaceutical drugs, because how else do you get rid of them? If you don't flush them down the toilet.
There are incinerators licensed by the Environmental Protection Agency that burn at extremely high temperatures, thousands of degrees, that will destroy these substances. It is not your standard autoclave. There is a great myth that if you throw the drug into the red burn bag, everything is going to be fine. Sadly, those burn bags, those red bags we've seen in hospitals and in doctor's offices, go to burn facilities that burn at a low temperature and cannot destroy the chemical bounds between the chemicals.
So what Mel says is that it comes down as rain.
No. The incinerators should be able to, if operating properly as they do, should be able to burn those substances effectively destroy them. But there's an interesting point here that many, many years ago, there were clean air regulations put into place that shut down hospital incinerators,
right,
leaving them really no alternative but other disposal mechanisms.
The toilet.
The toilet or the municipal landfill. And we now have specially designed incinerators to address these chemicals.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. Right back when we come back, what do we do? Do stay tuned. Well, it's a case of what goes around comes around. What goes around are pharmaceutical drugs. 300 million of us probably take drugs of one kind or another. We take them to wake up in the morning. We take them to stay awake at midday. And at night, we take them to go down. And so what happens with all of these drugs? Well, we flush them down the toilet, right? And those who live downstream take them again, whether they want to or not, in minute particles, but they're there. So what can we do with all of these drugs? Maybe we can burn them. Let's ask Rick. Rick, thank you for tuning in the Food Chain. You used to work in making incinerators. Can we burn up these drugs?
Yes. It's not even new technology, Michael. It dates back to the early 70s, where we came up with these incinerators that fire at about 2,000 degrees, and it breaks everything down into carbon dioxide and water vapor, plus whatever metallic content there is, which is oxidized to a salt, and there's nothing left. We actually, the company actually built the incinerators that disposed of all those leaking and failing nerve gas containers up in Utah 36 years ago.
So it's feasible to burn it then?
Very feasible.
And it won't come down as rain?
No.
Okay. Well, Rick, thank you very much for that call. That's some hopeful notion. Alan Roberson, American Water Works Association, what do you think? Should we burn this stuff?
Well, that sounds like it's the most appropriate technology. I'm not a solid waste, hazardous waste expert, mm-hmm. but I have some awareness of it and am aware that those high-temperature incinerators do the trick. So it's really just a question of the education and the training to send those, you know, take them out of the normal sort of water stream or the municipal waste stream, the normal garbage, and get them to those appropriate incinerators.
George?
I think it's pretty common sense. We need to do two things. We need to educate you and I that we should turn our unused drugs into some place, which means our legislators need to give us a place to turn it to.
I'm taking it to my congressman's office.
Well, that's right. Your congressman, by gosh, should help
Here, you deal with it.
Yeah, should help establish a program that you and I can take them back. That's not done except in a few places in the country.
Okay.
The other thing that we need to do is to have our Environmental Protection Agency work with our medical professionals in hospitals and nursing homes to explain to them what they have to do, give them some time to understand that, and then go out and enforce it and make them separate those hazardous substances and send them to those incinerators that Rick talked about.
You know, it occurs to me that each and every one of us, whether working in a hospital or, you know, just getting a prescription from the doctor, we just have to bear in mind that what goes around does come around, that we take these drugs does not mean the drugs go away. They go into our water and downstream to somebody else. So it's just something that we all have to bear in mind, whatever we do with these drugs, and we all seem to do something with them. Folks, I want to thank you for joining us today on The Food Chain. Special thanks to George Menina and Alan Roberson for joining us. Alan with the American Water Works Association, and George, an attorney with Nossaman LLP in Washington, D.C., and you. Remember, if you didn't get a chance to ask your questions or make your comments, you can do so on the forums page at metroforum.com. Now, see you all next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain. And remember, folks, cheap food isn't. Thank you, George. Thank you,
Thank
Alan.
You. Thanks.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.